Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Mary, and I'll be hosting today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to all majors here, locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers online classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite all students to go next door to our office or to our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's panel is Gun Policy in the United States, Regulation, Rights, and Responsibilities in an Armed Republic. I'll now introduce you to Dr. Ron Rubinar to introduce our panel. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome. Today's topic is guns and the Constitution, and we have brought three distinguished guests here to discuss this. To my immediate left is Julie Stewart, professor of sociology here at the University of Utah. And Julie will be discussing a comparative perspective on guns, looking at different countries around the world and how they deal with the issue of guns in their society. Immediate to her left is Mark Button, professor of political science, and Mark will bring a philosophical, ethical, and practical approach to the question of what we should do about guns and what societies can do about guns. And to his immediate left is Clark Apoljian, and he is the, I have to go to my second sheet of notes, Utah Shooting Sports Council Chairman. So he brings a perspective of the practical application of guns and the sporting nature of guns in our society. So we have three different perspectives. As all of you have noted, guns are in the news, either from the massacres that periodically occur in America or the debates about what laws should be passed in terms of restricting guns, or the discussion of the Second Amendment. And the Second Amendment has been much in the news for the last 3 years because of 2-5-4 Supreme Court decisions that essentially provided for a reinterpretation of the Second Amendment in terms of looking at it not from a militia point of view as the historical interpretation by the Supreme Courts had given it, but to an individual rights interpretation. And after that, it was then applied to the states in the various decisions in Washington, D.C. and Chicago, Illinois. So the question of the Second Amendment is one which is often in the news but is often confusing. So what we're trying to do today is to shed some light and information and knowledge on guns in American society. So I'll turn it over to Julie. Each speaker will be given approximately 10 minutes, and then we'll open it up for audience discussion, and we'll carry it as long as we have time, up to a possible limit of 11 o'clock. Julie?
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank the organizers of this. I don't think I can talk and do technology at the same time. Okay, let me get there. Okay. So I'd like to thank the organizers of this panel. I think this is a really important discussion. Can everyone hear me if I stand right here? Okay. So this is a really important discussion that we're having, and it's a real privilege for me to be able to be part of it today. Just to give you a little bit of background, I grew up in Utah. I first started shooting a BB gun at about age 6. My dad set up a target off of the, we would sit on the second floor balcony of our house. There was a target out there that my dad would set up for me and my older brother, and we had a really great time. And I don't know that my parents were always around when we were doing that, but we had a lot of fun with our BB gun. I grew up eating venison that my dad caught. That wasn't always my first choice when the menu was presented to me, but my father is an avid hunter, and every time we get together for family reunions, we always go out target shooting. So I'm not someone who is unfamiliar with guns, but I think that what I want to talk about today is the way that this discussion about guns has become so polarized, and I want to give you some statistics on what having guns in your possession really means today. Think about who supports gun control, who opposes it, and some of the interests around why that may be. So the title of my talk is Reflections on Gun Violence in the USA. Should we regulate better or arm more? Somewhat provocative title, but I think you're going to find that my presentation isn't nearly as polarized as the presentation might suggest. Okay, so first of all, as was discussed in the introduction, I think all of us are very aware of the problem of guns in the USA. Historically, and then very recently, we've had a series of high-profile killing, mass killings, including the killing of 26 people in Newtown, Connecticut, most recently. We have the very tragic Aurora, Colorado shooting in which 12 moviegoers were killed and 58 people were wounded in a theater. Of course, all of us in the university setting remember Virginia Tech and the killing of 32 people, which included the student responsible for the attack. And then, of course, going back more historically, I think what really started this debate was the Columbine killing, which killed 15 people, including two students. And that, of course, happened in 1999. And I think we're all really aware of these high-profile mass killings, and this really started us as a society to think about what is behind this, what looks like a trend. Well, I think that one of the things that many of us don't reflect on is the fact that maybe one of the factors behind these high-profile killings is that gun ownership in the U.S. is incredibly extensive. We have approximately 5% of the world's population, yet, depending upon how you count the guns, we own, as globally, 35 to 50% of all of the world's civilian-owned guns. So we have the highest gun ownership rate in the world, an average of 88 guns per 100 people. So, and I would guess I would say my dad has 6 guns, so he's a little over, he's helping to skew things a little bit. But that puts us number one in the world for gun ownership. Another thing that we don't often talk about is that a lot of people die every day because of guns. And this is not the high-profile killings of white people in schools, but this is the on average between 30,000 and 33,000 Americans that die every day. These are disproportionately minorities. These are disproportionately young men. These are disproportionately poor people. And these people, their deaths go by and they fly completely under the radar. No one talks about, or very few people talk about these deaths. And I want to highlight that it is really important that we talk about these deaths, because these deaths are overwhelmingly disproportionately numerically than the sort of high-profile mass killings that take place that get a lot of media attention. So one of the reasons why, when we think about how many Americans die every year because of guns, that brings us to the point that the homicide rate in the U.S. is about 20 times higher than in any other advanced nation. So, of course, there are more gun-related deaths in Mexico, but in terms of countries that are similar to the U.S., in terms of our economic profile, 20 times higher we are than most other advanced nations. And I thought another important fact that I found out in my research is that since Senator and presidential candidate Robert Kennedy was assassinated in 1968, more Americans have died from gunfire than from all wars in U.S. history. So that is a data point that I think bears a lot of reflection. Okay, now, something else that you may not know, and this is very counterintuitive, is that actually gun violence in the U.S. is on the decline. And if you look here, maybe my clicker doesn't work, but you can see you can basically see the trends that, if looking from 1960 to 2010, in fact, violent crime as a rate per thousand is much lower than it once was. The murder rate per 100,000 people is much lower than it once was. And people's reported fears of whether or not they're afraid to walk alone at night is also low. So in the media, it sounds like there's mass murder happening everywhere. But the reality, statistically speaking, is that we're much safer now than we used to be. So I think that's something that we don't often talk about, and I really wanted to highlight that because when you get your information, for example, from the nighttime news, it's not going to give you these kind of stats, and these kind of stats are really important. But nevertheless, between 30 and 30,000 people dying every year in the U.S., that is something critically important, and we should figure out what's causing it and what are the possible solutions. Now, I want to take a step back for just a second and read you this quote and ask you, who do you think said this quote? Okay, so this person said, "I do not believe in taking away the right of the citizen for sporting, for hunting, or so forth, or for home defense. But I do believe that an AK-47, a machine gun, is not a sporting weapon or needed for defense of a home. This is a matter of vital importance to the public safety. While we recognize that assault weapon legislation will not stop all assault weapon crime, statistics prove that we can dry up the supply of these guns, making them less accessible to criminals. Certain forms of ammunition have no legitimate sporting, recreational, or self-defense use, and thus should be prohibited. With the right to bear arms comes a great responsibility to use caution and common sense handgun purchases." So, who do you think said that? Yes! How did you all know that? Okay, so the reason why I highlighted this is because most people think, oh, that's something crazy that Nancy Pelosi said, or Barack Obama, or some crazy leftist liberal. And in fact, this was mainstream thought in the 1980s, and it came from none other than our president, Ronald Reagan, one of the most conservative Republican presidents we've known for some time. And it was a part of the gun debates following his assassination attempt. And so what I wanted to highlight here is what is seen in some quarters as very radical, that we should ban assault weapons perhaps, that we should dramatically reduce the amount of ammunition that people can buy and carry. That was once totally mainstream. Okay, so now I want to move to a couple of solutions. So we have a whole range of solutions here. And basically, in light of these different broad killings, there have been a lot of different kinds of solutions proposed. Some come from citizens, and those revolve around doing things as simple as posting a sign on your house that says, "This is a gun-free zone," and that's a sign that you're not a fan of guns. In the middle area, we have a lot of different actions that correspond more to what the government might do in terms of banning or restricting assault rifles, banning or restricting the amount of ammunition one can carry, etc. And then we have in our final category some of the things that basically are programs in existence but could require more funding, such as basically supporting gun buyback programs in communities, or basically providing more resources for people who have contact with people who are likely to use guns, those with a background of having been in a domestic abuse situation, domestic violence situation, those with a criminal record, etc., providing more support and resources for those people who would be considered at risk. Okay, so there's a whole range of solutions that you can reflect on there. The different people that have come together to support these kinds of solutions, basically in my research, I came up with 22 different citizen-based organizations. I'm just highlighting four of them here. And basically, some of the actions they've done is try to make sure that someone, a political candidate who rates an A from the National Rifleman Association, is basically forced out of their bid for a political candidacy. Mayors Against Illegal Guns has brought together about 1.3 million people to try and come meet with their legislators to try and talk about gun control, to try and inform them on the issues. Organizing for Action did a special lobbying day in D.C. where they brought in 120 family members who themselves were survivors or family members of victims of gun violence to really talk about the issue and bring it home. And then another organization that was basically a member of change.org started a petition, got 45,000 people to sign that said, President Obama, you need to come to Chicago, because Chicago is a place where so many of those people, those between 30 and 30,000 people, it's people like us that are being killed every day, not the kids in elementary schools in Connecticut. And as a response to that petition, he came. So this is sort of a range of the kinds of solutions and the kinds of groups that have come together to try and bring about a conversation around how we might control guns and reduce gun violence. I've got 5 more minutes.
I'm granting you.
Okay. I'm almost actually done. So All right. So on the other side of the spectrum, and again, I'm kind of looking at two sides of the spectrum. We have a group of people who would like to make it easier for citizens to purchase and carry guns. They would like to staff schools with armed security guards or provide more police to schools. They would like to permit or encourage teachers to bring guns to schools. And they also say, well, what we just need to do is enforce existing gun laws on how people purchase, carry, and store guns. Well, in my research, I uncovered that this is not necessarily entirely a citizen effort, that behind many of these proposals is one main actor, that being the National Rifle Association. This is an organization that's been in existence for 142 years. It comprises between 4 and 5 million members, so it has a lot of members, a lot of grassroots people that are a part of it. And one of the things the NRA has done has encouraged its members to pressure lawmakers to support its anti-gun control measures. And I think that in a lot of respects, the perspective of the NRA can be summarized by this one statement by Wayne LaPierre, I believe is the pronunciation of his name. So he's long opposed any measures to regulate or control guns. And basically he says, listen, the solution is simple. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And we can debate that in the Q&A if that's actually true. But the other thing that we need to highlight is that the NRA is not exactly a disinterested actor in this issue. In the last two decades, the NRA has increasingly relied on the support of a $12 billion a year gun industry, and that's made up of manufacturers and sellers of firearms, ammunition, and related gun items. After heavy NRA lobbying, Congress approved a measure that gave gun makers and gun distributors basically unprecedented immunity from any kind of lawsuits that might be leveraged against them as a consequence of gun violence. The NRA has received a huge amount of donations from different corporate actors that are tied to the gun industry. And then what the NRA is able to do is then funnel that money in support of political candidates that support an anti-gun control measure. Okay, so I think that that's just important to think about the playing field and the actors. Who has money, who has doesn't, who has a lot of numbers, who doesn't. I just want a final, this is my final slide, which is what is to be done? The great question posed by Vladimir Lenin. And one of the things that I think that we need to remember is that for every instance in which a gun in the home was shot in self-defense, there were 7 criminal assaults or homicides, 4 accidental shootings, and 11 attempted or successful suicides. So this brings home what happens when you have guns in your home. I also wanted to highlight a great quote from Philip Cook of Duke University that says, every state has a requirement that cosmetologists are licensed, but only 17 states control gun licenses. So you can't do someone's hair without a license, but you can own a gun without a license. That seems a little odd to me. Now, common sense approaches. Fully 85% of Americans favor making private gun sales and sales at gun shows subject to background checks, meaning that if you have a criminal record, you've been charged with or indicted, you've been found to be guilty of domestic violence, or you have mental instability, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun. And there's almost a similar level of support to prevent people who are mentally ill from purchasing guns. And so I think that what I want to encourage us all to think about is the common sense solutions that we can all agree on to try and reduce the everyday violence and the high-profile violence that is really plaguing America today. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Our next speaker is Clark Kapozian, who is the chairman of the Utah Shooting Sports Council. Clark.
I have to put this somewhere where I can do a Mark Rubio thing. Okay. Julie, this is your... Can I...
Okay. Yeah, sorry. Let's get that...
This comes off her time.
It does.
Is that okay just like that?
Can or I do you want me to... I just got to put this down somewhere. Is that okay?
See, I think so. I think then it can pop back up.
And can we flick a light on? Oh, that's perfect. Thank you. Fantastic. Okay. I'm Clark Kapozian. I'm known as the gun lobbyist here in Utah. I chair the Utah Shooting Sports Council, which is the biggest gun rights group. We have tens of thousands of well-wishers and considerably fewer paid memberships, about $20 a year to become a member. I come from the San Francisco Bay Area, and I came out here to go to school back in 1988, and Professor Rebner was one of my professors at the time. So it's good to see him again. And I want it to give me an extra 5 minutes, right?
No.
And, you know, growing up, I didn't grow up with handguns in the house at all. We had three rifles, and one was a 22 bolt action rifle that was my dad's back when he was a kid. Dad also had a 30-30 lever action rifle. That's the, you know, like the one John Wayne used in a lot of his movies, and he used that for deer hunting when he was a kid. And he had a new 308, a more modern semi-automatic rifle. It was a deer rifle. It's all wood with engravings on it and that. And they were just kept down in the basement in a big cedar chest, as I recall. They only really brought out for hunting, and that was it. We didn't do target shooting. We didn't do anything. And really not much hunting. I remember, you know, going with my dad out to Utah probably twice in my whole life. So it wasn't, I certainly didn't grow up in a gun culture. My dad was Navy, though. He was at Pearl Harbor when it was attacked, so there was a lot of, and he was an extremely patriotic man. I'm a first-generation Armenian, and dad was from Armenia. In fact, the area right around Aleppo in Syria. Just to give you a little bit of background. You would think that in all the comments and the issue of guns in society, that with all the talk in government and in the media and at workplaces and in your homes, that we would have solved the gun issue, this gun debate, this problem with everything from beginning to end on guns, we would have solved that so long ago. Obviously, we haven't. We're here today. So I'm hoping that today we can actually solve this and we can walk out. Everything will be done. I think that'll work out good. All right. I just need Mark and Julie to go ahead and agree to everything I say, and then everything will just be, it will work out great. Okay. We've split into sides, though. We're going to hear some rhetoric, some from me today. But I fully understand that rhetoric does not necessarily foster communication. It's not a problem-solving method. Rather, it fosters mistrust and lack of communication. It tends to make the other side retreat to their base, get behind a wall, and defend themselves. That's what we see in the gun debate on both sides. Okay. The ground rules for this type of debate really should be, if we could control it, should be a rhetoric-free zone. We need to focus on trust issues, communication, and perception issues. A lot like what they do in like a marriage or a relationship counseling class. They get rid of all the junk and the perception problems, and they boil it right down, and they talk about trust, and they talk about communication. So let me see if I can sum up our sides. a little bit. In reality, my adversaries, see, even the word adversary is adversarial, but my adversaries, they don't trust Utahns with firearms. They don't trust Americans. They don't trust mankind with firearms. And I know that's a little harsh. Oh, you know, we trust you a little bit. But no, I mean, in reality, you don't really trust us. And, you know, given the perception of problems with firearms. We understand that. We get that. Okay? And in reality, we, my base, doesn't trust them to stop at just what they would consider reasonable gun laws, meaningful restrictions. We see them taking more and more, well, all the while crime is not affected by these gun laws, yet they still try more and more gun laws. We don't trust them to stop at a certain point. Now, those who control the terms of the debate, the words used, generally control the debate. And that's been a big fight, especially lately. Let's talk about some of these terms that we use. Let's see if they ring any bells with you. Assault weapons. Before 1984, there was no such term. It was coined in San Francisco. I mean, I guess any weapon could be an assault weapon. There are things called assault rifles. They are very specifically, they are machine guns of a select fire. You know, you can either do semi or fully automatic. And they fire a medium caliber round. That's an assault rifle. Okay? But assault weapons, I mean, why do you think they use the term assault? It was meant to demonize. It was meant to be that knee-jerk reactionary. When we talk about these semi-automatic rifles, they insert the word assault in them, they automatically become bad. Hear the term killing machines. Hear the term, you know, so many misleading statistics. The rhetoric, gun crime rather than just crime, rather than just violent crime. What does it matter if a person is shot with a gun versus hit over the head and killed with a baseball bat? Apparently one is better than the other. Asking the other side, why do you need a semi-automatic firearm? Why do you need an assault weapon? Why do you need a killing machine? Why do you need a magazine that holds 30 rounds of ammunition? Knowing full well that no matter what I say in response to that is going to satisfy them for my desire to have one of these. Okay. Some will say that even though some drastic gun control measures are not guaranteed to be effective, they may save one life and that's worth it. No, it isn't. We are not interested in solutions that save one life. Those are the kind of solutions, the kind that save the one life, usually by accident, while the rest of the time, because our attention has been occupied by these ineffective laws, our attention is off the real solutions to the problem. The assault weapon ban is a classic example of that. And here's my first kind of statistic. Less than 1% of overall crime is committed with these semi-automatic firearms. I call them sport utility rifles. That's my little insert into the debate. Less than 2% of gun crime is committed with these semi-automatic firearms. About 3% of overall crime or deaths associated with guns are committed with these semi-automatic firearms. And I'm sure you're thinking, oh, this can't be true. Dianne Feinstein said, I'm sure she said somewhere that 98% of crime was used with these things. Because that's what they want you to think. So even if you were to magically evaporate all these rifles off the face of the planet, you'd affect 1% of overall crime. And I think that my adversaries, my detractors, actually believe that we, our supporters, like violence, that we're okay with it, that we accept it as a fait accompli for having guns. We don't. We are law-abiding firearms, our supporters. We'd make no apology for criminals or anybody that uses firearms inappropriately. We're tired of being demonized. We're tired of made to be sit in the back of the bus, so to speak. Representative Carol Spackman Moss, I don't know if you heard about her new bill. She has a bill that says if you're a school teacher and you have a concealed carry permit, you must notify the principal, who will then allow the parents of the students within that class to be notified so that they can pull them out. if I've ever heard more back-of-the-bus kind of demonology against firearm owners, and those people that have, one, passed a background check to become a teacher, are usually the most highly educated people in society, and three, pass a daily background check, but yet we still want to allow our parents to say, I don't want my kid in a school with your kind. That's the back-of-the-bus thing I'm talking about. This painting with a broad brush is purposely designed to portray all gun owners as criminals or potential criminals, or so dangerous because they choose to have a firearm that you know what, I think they'd be happy if they just put us on an island. We'll all eventually just kill ourselves off anyways because, you know, we'll get into an argument and blast each other away, or we'll accidentally shoot each other. That's kind of what we're getting here. You know, the terms, let's learn the terms. I think that my side needs to learn their terms. Their side need to learn our terms. AR, as in AR-15, what does it stand for? It does not stand for automatic rifle. It does not stand for assault rifle. Stands for the company that made it, Armalite. Gosh, that ruins everything now. Military style. When we think of military style, we instantly think of AK-47s and AR-15s, the military equivalent of the semi-automatic equivalent of fully automatic machine gun. Military style firearms are also bolt action firearms. We have been using military style firearms since we've been using firearms, for goodness sakes. And all the modern sporting weapons, including shotguns, are derived from military style. But it doesn't make a lot of, it doesn't give the other side so much ground to call them, you know. Saturday night specials, I guess that's anything that's about $100 that's an economical firearm for lawful self-defense. And then other things that just kind of grate on me like nails on a chalkboard. Clips and magazines, they're not the same thing. Bullets and ammunition are not the same thing. Flash hiders and muzzle brakes are not the same thing. And pretty much every rifle out there has a pistol grip, including sporting rifles. Bayonet lugs. You know, that was part of the assault weapon ban, bayonet lugs. They wanted to demonize this military-style little knob on the end of the barrel so badly that they figured that they would stop random drive-by bayoneting, I guess. I tell you, I can't think of a time, and I have lots of guns that have these little bayonet lugs. You can put a knife on the end. I can't remember a time I've ever put a bayonet on the end of it, ever. And I'm a gun nut. We prefer firearms enthusiasts, but anyway. Semi-auto versus automatic. Semi-auto is, just so you know, one bullet is fired per trigger pull. So boom, boom. All right, fully automatic is you hold it down and it just keeps firing. Those are available. They are, you know, for a standard semi-automatic rifle, we're talking about $1,000. The ones that are available in fully automatic firearm mode are closer to $25,000 for the same gun. Okay, and it is federally registered. But they are legal. I think what we need to do in this discussion, how much time do I have left? 2 minutes. Let's identify the real problem. Let's identify the actual causes of the problem and identify actual solutions. Let's not get stuck on these assault weapon bans and magazines when, if you're going to, you know, do those, they're going to end up coming back to us later and saying, you know what? We still have crime. We still have gun crime. So obviously this bill, this law didn't work. This restriction didn't work. Let's up the new restrictions. Obviously our assault weapon ban wasn't strong enough, so we need to ramp it up. If you're going to continue doing that, you'll never solve the problem. So identify actual solutions. And I really look at it. There's suicides. There's mass shootings. There's general gun crime. There's legal intervention to police, including by police and self-defense. And there's accidents. Those are how those 30 to 32,000 deaths occur each year. About half of them are suicides. Yeah, and they're done with guns. Is it a gun problem, the suicide? Well, let's look at Japan. Japan has a higher rate of suicide than we do in the United States, much higher, yet they don't use guns. So is it a gun problem there? No, it's a mental health problem. We need to stop with the guns and start helping those folks, giving them a solution other than killing themselves. And general gun crime, you know, I've looked at this from every angle, and I've been doing this for a long time. Crime is not spread evenly across the United States like so much Nutella on a piece of toast. It's centered, it's concentrated in the urban areas, and it's concentrated among the minority community. They're killing themselves. We've got to figure out a problem to that. It's a cultural problem again. Yeah, they're using guns, but it's not a gun problem. Okay. And I have so much more, but you know what? I'm going to save it for next time. Thank you very much.
Water?
There we go.
And we have to set up. As you can see, in the spirit of the Hinckley Institute, we will have a spirited discussion on these issues, and different perspectives will be offered. Our next speaker is Dr. Mark Button from the Department of Political Science. Mark, I think you could take one off.
Yeah, unclip it, and then you can use it.
And use that for the question and answer session, and use this one here.
We need to dim the lights on again. I ask for your indulgence here. My very first PowerPoint presentation, so we'll see how this goes. I want to thank very much the Political Science Undergraduate Student Advisory Committee for putting this together, the Hinckley Institute of Politics for hosting. And Samantha Brody, our undergraduate advisor, can you stand up? You're the one who put this whole thing together, really. She deserves a round of applause. This is an important event. It's a timely event, and I'm very happy to be a part of it. Now, as a political theorist, not a criminologist or a lobbyist, I want to, in the brief time that I have, address the philosophical underpinnings of Second Amendment jurisprudence in the United States. And after drawing from that history, I want to try to offer a normative framework that might usefully inform the debates about gun policy in the United States. In the American political tradition, the right to property in one's person and possessions is the right from which all other civil and political rights are derived. The right to keep and bear arms is part of a philosophical, cultural, and legal framework that has long tied the equal moral right to life, to property, and the means of self-defense together in an indissoluble mix. Just want to make sure everyone's familiar with the Second Amendment, so there it is. Now, well over a century of jurisprudential interpretation of the Second Amendment might be summarized as follows. I'm going to put a century of judicial interpretation into one sentence, and here it goes. There is a common law right to self-defense, which the U.S. Constitution ratifies and protects. And there is a collective public interest exercised by localities, states, and the federal government to provide for public protection against the unlawful use of dangerous weapons. Let me briefly note here that balancing private rights with public responsibilities was a good deal easier when the right to keep and bear arms was tied to one's civic responsibilities within a well-regulated militia, as you can see here, from documents from 1776 that served as the sources, the state and colonial sources for the Second Amendment, where they make plain that not only is there a universal male obligation to serve in militias, but in the case of Pennsylvania, they actually made religious exemptions to get out of the militia because it was just expected of you. In other words, the right to carry arms was tied to a civic political responsibility to the freedom of the state, so that Quakers in this instance were required to carry arms, but they still had to pay their way out. Now, in this policy domain, as in so many others, we have increasingly dropped the civic for the individual and are now left with the task of trying to retrofit public responsibility for the protection of personal rights through the coercive instruments of law. And of course, many responsible gun owners resent this moralizing project, and those who know something of the history of the original sources of the Second Amendment regret the eclipse of the civic dimensions of this right. In this setting, it is also important to remember that the state, that is just to say the government, has always provided the basic conditions of both law and security with which individual rights hold any legal or substantive meaning. As you can see here from passages both from William Blackstone, the great English jurist of the 18th century, to Justice Scalia, most recently in D.C. versus Heller, you get a clear recognition of this throughout the jurisprudential record. To again summarize in one sentence, for as long as there have been firearms in America, and even before there were firearms in America, there have been regulations on their use, on who can use them, who can have access to them, what types of weapons, and so on. This means that the simple opposition between the state and autonomous natural rights, or concentrated political power and absolute personal freedom, have always been more illusory or blindly ideological than real, because they have always been stuck together. The words regulation and right are bound together in the Second Amendment, no less than in the history of the Republic itself. Contemporary Americans tend to lose sight of this, believing that rights and regulations are antithetical concepts. But for the framers of the Constitution, as with a long litany of American jurists, the liberties, personal liberties without regulation or restraint, tend toward anarchy, and coercive regulations without respect for diverse forms of personal freedom tend toward tyranny. And the practical question is, then, how do you balance against, not facilitate, those extremes? And that's now the question I want to try to turn to. Okay, I've given you a really brief course through jurisprudence, and now on to some more practical questions. Now, starting with the basic insight, born out of centuries of bloodshed, that a fearful people is not a free people, the American system of law ensures to all citizens an equal freedom to pursue one's life without fear of arbitrary, unjustifiable violence, coercion, or domination. But from that common ground, Americans quickly divide into opposing views and sentiments in relationship to the possession and the regulation of firearms. For many Americans, the right to keep and bear arms is constitutive of this freedom from fear. We lose our basic freedom of a life free of fear if we compromise our rights to the possession of guns, and we should be extremely wary of any steps, however well-intended, that would begin to take us down that path. And I think Clark has spoken to that quite well. For many other Americans, the widespread availability of guns, something like 300 million in total, and the number of firearm deaths, which Professor Stewart has talked about, is constitutive of the loss of freedom from fear, and we should resent being placed in that kind of circumstance. Now, the former view expresses skepticism and a distrust of state power, and the latter view expresses a sense of public betrayal by that same authority. And both sides of this debate are on solid ground when they claim to represent part of the core meaning of the American system of freedom and law. And both sides are equally mistaken when they claim exclusive and final authority over that system, for each of these currents have always run deep within the American political tradition. One of the basic questions that this country faces with respect to this particular area, and it's true in other policy domains as well, is whether citizens and political leaders can acknowledge both of these sets of views and not seek to make their truths and their sentiments true for others, or demonize them for failing to convert to what they perceive to be the right opinion on these matters. For any policy related to guns to find democratic legitimacy under contemporary conditions, it will have to address both poles of opinion and sentiment and give each of them their due, not theoretically or rhetorically, but substantively. And then the question becomes, well, what would that look like? Given the jurisprudential framework that I've outlined, I think this means the following. First, acknowledging the personal right to bear and keep and bear arms as constitutive of the right of property and personal security. And second, acknowledging that a society that takes the moral obligation to respect personal rights seriously also creates the conditions for the abuse of the rights of gun ownership. Rights and the abuse of rights have always gone together, men not being angels. But a wise society will employ auxiliary measures to address these inevitable dilemmas. I'm channeling James Madison here for any of you who have read the Federalist Papers. The first claim directs us to preserve the Second Amendment as an individual right, and the second claim directs us to preserve the public conditions within which that right alone has meaning. And here, some public opinion data in support of universal background checks is relevant and I think gives room for some optimism because it indicates widespread common support across various different demographic, ideological, and interest group lines for ways of simultaneously preserving a right to possess and the simultaneous concern to preserve the public conditions within which those rights are exercised. And I think we should all be desperate for optimism in this domain. And here's one of them. Now, in public policy debates, where reasonable minds differ profoundly over the proper course of action, trade-offs must be made if we're going to treat each other as moral equals while seeking to find workable public agreements amid our differences. Balancing incompatible views in a climate of political polarization has always been the fate of citizens living in a free society, and it's no different now than it was in 1778. The trade-off in this area is how the society will go about addressing the equitable distribution of the freedom from fear, recognizing that we reasonably fear very different things, and thus discern threats to our freedom and preferred manner of living from very different kinds of sources. And so in the interest of trying to advance this discussion, I'm going to offer my own trade-off in this realm. And it's meant as provocation for discussion and debate. It's not law-giving. First, mentally competent, law-abiding gun owners' fears that their right to keep and bear arms will be undermined by the federal government should be allayed as far as possible. And the general public's fear that guns, and especially large-capacity magazines that facilitate massive slaughter will be used against them, must also be allayed as far as possible. Concealed weapons permit systems, assuming adequate provisions are made for background checks and safety training, should be sustained, not weakened. So-called constitutional carry laws should be abandoned or rescinded. These laws, like the one proposed in the Utah legislature, HB 76, do not take seriously the desire of their fellow citizens to lead their lives without fear. By allowing weapons to be concealed without a permit, constitutional carry undermines the checks on the legal ownership of concealed weapons and also undermines the limited safety provisions that are built into concealed permit laws like those in Utah. Alternatively, a bill like House Bill 268, Representative Paul Ray's bill, which clarifies that displaying a dangerous weapon in certain circumstances is a form of disorderly conduct, while permitting open carry, shows respectful consideration for a diverse public. And it strikes me that these two bills are working in very different directions. But if we were to bring more normative philosophic coherence to this discussion, we might look at it a little bit differently. Now, to conclude, there's one additional type of compromise that has to be considered, and that is a compromise with practical realities. I almost said assault weapons. I'll say sport utility weapons. Is that preferred? Sport utility. I don't care what we call them. Sport utility weapons. And bans on high-capacity magazines will not, on their own, generate significant reductions in gun-related violence or death. Clark is absolutely right here. These weapons account for a very small percentage of total gun-related deaths. And furthermore, going further, universal background checks will never be universally efficacious in keeping guns out of the hands of those who should not have them. But there is social science evidence to support the effectiveness of background checks in keeping weapons from high-risk persons, and reason to believe, based on comparative state data, that extending the class of prohibited persons could also help to reduce gun violence. And I'll just mention one. Not just prohibiting guns from people charged with domestic violence, but people charged with misdemeanor violence at all. In some states, they do that, and it has had a reduction in the number of guns being used in crimes. Still, there are significant limits to how much the law on its own can accomplish in our lives. Thus, we need to combine policy realism with moral aspiration. We should acknowledge, with the resolute opponents of gun control, that these policies cannot do all that their proponents sometimes claim or hope. But we should also acknowledge that the responsibility to perfect our union is forsaken without initiative, trial, fair evaluation, and retrial. Thank you for your attention.
So now we move to the second part of today's program, which is a discussion from the audience and specific questions. I ask you not to make speeches. This is an internet broadcast, and incidentally, the internet broadcast will conclude in about 12 or 13 minutes, and we'll have to wrap up that section. We can continue our question and answer session after the end of the formal internet session. So if you have specific questions, please identify which of our panelists you wish to address those questions to. And again, please make it a question and not a speech. Questions? Who has the microphone? Right here. This gentleman has the microphone. So raise your hand if you have a question. Shall we go over to that gentleman right over there? And you have your mics buttoned on?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
We have a knot.
We have a microphone that has a knot in it.
Just why not? Yell it. Just say it.
Yeah.
So my name is Jared Moore. I'm a political science major here at the U. And my question is for Julie. She mentioned the 30 to 33,000, mostly white or not minority males who die every year from gun violence. I would imagine that most of those come from gang violence and things of that nature. And so I would assume that most of those firearms are not obtained through legal means anyways. So would gun legislation, in your opinion, actually have an effect on that statistic?
Is this working? It
yes.
does.
Yes.
It is. Okay. Well, I want to clarify a couple of things. One is that in terms of overall gun deaths, suicide rates vary highly, as does accidental deaths. So that is something that we need to, I think several panelists spoke of, and that's something that we need to think about in terms of the entire gun debate. In terms of the other everyday deaths that we tend to see concentrated in low-income communities of racial ethnic minorities, here's how most of these people, this is how most of these guns are purchased. Basically, some states have big shows where you can go in and you can buy 50 guns. There are a lot, and so you can legally buy those guns. Then what you get to do is you get to go across to the next state and illegally sell those guns. So basically, there's illegality involved in that chain, not at the point of purchase, but at the point of repurchase. And so my solution to that problem would be that we need to really clamp down on what you can purchase at a gun, legally purchase at a gun sale. I don't think any individual should be able to purchase 50 guns, because what person needs 50 guns? And I think that gets to the issue of you have an individual right to arm and defend yourself, but if you're buying 50 guns, boom, I am suspicious about you, and I suspect that you are probably going to cross a state line where gun laws are very different, where it's much harder to buy a gun, and you're going to illegally sell those guns. So actually producing new laws around gun big gun show sales, I think could make a big difference.
Clark, would you like to quickly respond to
that? Just quickly, there's actually two laws broken there. When you buy the 50 guns with the intent of selling them across state lines, and then you go across state lines and sell the guns, it's two crimes. If you buy the gun with the intent of selling it to someone who would not be able to lawfully own it, that's already a federal crime and a state crime here in Utah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Another question, please.
Hello, my name is Satine, and I'm a political science major pre-med. My question for you, sir.
Clark.
My question is, my view of the gun control debate is kind of tarnished because I feel that the same people that are advocating for gun control are also, not to stray from the gun control debate, are the same people who have advocated that are against abortion. And the debates they make against abortion have very much to do with the ethics of life. And so it's hard for me to take what the gun control people keep talking about, rights, and where they're the same people that are talking about how pro-life they are and how Christian they are and so forth, turn around and discount all the lives that are being taken from gun violence, both on the record and under the radar, and that aren't even accounted for. That makes sense. I just wanted to hear your reaction.
I mean, I understand that contrast of efforts. Yeah, and so your comment or your question was more of a statement, and I'll just say that yes, I do recognize that. It is also interesting along those same lines how my detractors constantly talk about gun deaths and gun violence and the carnage and the killings. And focus on that. They seem to be obsessed with this. Yet, I'll call my side, our supporters, our base, we talk about self-defense, we talk about sanctity of life, preservation, these type of things. We try to stay away from that. It's the words we use that really color that debate. But your point is well taken on that change from loving life and trying to ban guns, and then also with the abortion debate.
No, not necessarily on that, although in my comments I was trying to take for granted that among the things that we can share is a moral value in human life and a life that's free of fear. And so what I was groping for there is a philosophical ground that might serve to unite what is otherwise polarizing points of view. And if you can work out a conception of a legal framework that tries to take seriously what we can agree on, at least up to now I think we can agree on the value of moral life and a life free of fear, and then take seriously the sources of that fear, then you might be able to start finding reasonable legal mechanisms to address that. And I was emphasizing in particular the value and the broad public support that surrounds universal background checks. It goes to your question. In a study, and you saw the brief evidence that I provided, only 11.4% of purchased weapons used in crimes actually came from licensed dealers. We don't have a gun show loophole, as you hear about. We have a private secondary market loophole, and that's what has to be addressed. And there are lots of ways to do it. And I think that doing so would allow everyone concerned in this debate to take more seriously the value that they put on life and a life free of fear.
Thank you. Professor Stewart is not boycotting the rest of our discussion. She has a class to teach, as sometimes occurs at the University of Utah. Another question right there, the gentleman in the blue.
Okay. I wanted to make a comment. Professor Stewart, as she left, she cited a statistic of 20 times the homicide rate. You know, the U.S. supposedly has 20 times the homicide rate of other industrialized nations. And I was going to say, I've looked at homicide rates. We have a rate lower than Russia. We have a rate similar to Latvia, similar to Luxembourg. Utah specifically has a rate similar to the U.K. and to Canada. Were you speaking, when you were talking 20 times, I don't know of any country that has a rate a 20th of ours, were you speaking of just gun homicides or were you speaking of homicides? And isn't murder murder, whether it's guns or baseball bats?
So in the interest of time, I didn't. I have a graph that shows every member of the OECD countries. Those are the countries that belong to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. And so those are basically high-income countries with similar political forms of rule, et cetera. And so that graph is, and that is based on data collected by the United Nations and the one other international entity. So if you email me, I'd be happy to send you that slide and show you the comparison across all of those member nations, and those include many European nations, including Japan. That looks at homicide rates in general, but gun deaths are by far the largest contributor to homicides. So the two are highly correlated. Now, anyone who does social science knows correlation and causation are two different things, and perhaps some of the other speakers could comment on that. Mm-hmm. But when you look at overall homicide rates, I can send you the graph. Today, I didn't put it in for the interest of time, but gun-related homicides are by and far the single greatest contributor to homicides in the U.S. as they are to other countries. The other one point I want to make, and this is in response as I'm closing to go to my class on social theory, is that all weapons are not created equally. So why do we care if someone gets hit over the head or gets shot with a gun? Well, on the same day that the Newtown, Connecticut massacre happened, a mentally unstable young man in a Chinese village went and attacked a classroom. He had a knife. He attacked 20 people, 22 people, I believe. 22 people were wounded, and no one died. So when you have a gun and you attack people, the consequences are much less dire. When you have a gun and attack people, the consequences are often deadly. And so I think that's why we're going back to this issue of us being able to live in a situation in which we are free from fear. The fear that so many people feel is that when you are in a situation where someone has a gun, whether due to intent or due to accident, it is possible that someone is going to be killed. And so we need to have laws around guns that try to make those two outcomes as least likely as possible.
Thank you. Clark, do you have a quick response on that?
Not a super quick one, but yeah. Yes, there was that, I remember, and both sides have used the knife incident. Was it China?
It was China.
Yeah, it was China, to support their side, and I'm going to use it. 22 people, 22 individuals were stabbed with a knife. None of them died, yet 26 died with the use of gun. These are, quite honestly, anomalies and shouldn't be shown to be respectful of all knifings and all gun deaths or firearm usages. In fact, quite honestly, less than 3% of the people that are ever shot ever die. So firearms as killing machines are not all that great when we look at the stats. And a knife up close is just literally just as deadly as a gun is. Granted, it makes it an awful lot easier to kill someone, especially at greater distances, with a gun. We get that. I'll stipulate that. But then you've got to look at the cost versus benefit. How many people are actually killed with a gun versus how many people defend themselves every year with a firearm? It makes it so much easier to also defend yourself with a firearm. And we see many, many, many more instances of personal self-defense than we do offense.
Thank you. Another question? Young lady right here.
Hi, my name is Rochelle Roberts, and I was just curious, you both have kind of mentioned the constitutional carry laws that are becoming prevalent. I know one is in the Utah State Legislature right now. In real-world effects, how do we think that will affect it? Kind of what are your guys' opinions? I know you mentioned you were, for the most part, opposed to it, but I'm just kind of curious, what do we think the real-world effects will be?
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to start, and then I can...
Yeah, it's actually an extremely tiny change. It's HB 76, Representative Mathis's bill. It's a tiny change from where we are right now. You can all, I assume that you're all lawfully able to possess a firearm. You can put one on your hip right now. If you don't have a concealed carry permit, it has to be unloaded, which means, under Utah law, two manual actions to get it fired. You know, you have a full magazine in it, but an empty chamber, which takes about, you know, if you're trained, about half a second, literally, to engage that firearm. You can carry it openly. You cannot put a jacket on over it. This bill, once passed, would allow you to put a jacket on over it. It does not allow loaded anymore. It's been modified to disallow a loaded firearm unless you have a permit. And you still can't go into schools. You can't go on public transportation with it. Those are specific allowances for permit holders. But, yeah, you can go anywhere else. There's five other states that do it right now. To the degree that they are similar to Utah, probably Arizona is probably the only state that's similar to Utah. We haven't seen a pattern of problems associated with this what they call constitutional carry at this point. I get a feeling you want to say something. I think I've said enough. So,
no, I mean that's what the bill does. And my point about this is that it does a good deal more than just allow something about a guy with a horse being harassed by putting a coat over his gun.
That was the representative.
Right, yeah. An N of one led to this bill, from what I can gather. One guy got harassed by police that he was inadvertently covering his weapon, and that put him in violation of Utah law. Now, what the bill goes on to do, I think, in effect, I mean, we don't know. We'll see. But I'm hoping we don't get there. In allowing...
Mark, excuse me, we have to take a break right now. We have ended our internet time. This is an internet broadcast.
And we've
ended that. We will continue on, for those of you who have discussions and questions, for another 15 minutes, if you so choose to have questions. But we must terminate. We thank you for coming today. Please thank our two participants for a fine presentation. Professor Stewart, as well.